Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is James Seagroves, and I appear this afternoon on behalf of the company appellants in this matter. And with me at counsel's table is Tom Quinn, who served as trial counsel in this matter. And with the court's permission, we'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. As the court is aware, this case arises from the death of a nursing facility resident. After that resident was transferred to a local hospital, and as is relevant to the company's appeal, there were two claims that were tried to a jury in this case by the nursing facility resident's widow, Janice Regal. Those two claims, of course, were wrongful death and extreme and outrageous conduct. And the jury found in favor of Mrs. Regal on both of those claims. Of course, the briefs in this case raise a number of issues. There are three primary issues that the companies would like to discuss with the court this afternoon. The first of those relates to what, in fact, the standard is for causation in a wrongful death case in Colorado. The second relates to whether the trial court erred in submitting the outrageous conduct claim to the jury. And then finally, time permitting, we hope to at least address some of the issues with respect to punitive damages in this case. Now, with respect to wrongful death, of course, when we speak of wrongful death in Colorado, it is a statutory cause of action in derogation of the common law. And the statute itself, of course, requires that the claimant prove that the defendant's negligence caused the death of a person. The trial court in this case, however, in denying the company's motion for a directed verdict, held that it was sufficient for the plaintiff to put into evidence that the defendant's negligence increased the risk of death. We respectfully submit that that was legally erroneous, and in doing so, we admit, as we did in the court below, that the language of the trial court's decision does find support in the decision that a division of this court issued in 1985, namely the Sharp 1 decision. And as we explained in the trial court and as we explained in our briefs here, just 2 years ago, the Tenth Circuit, in predicting how the Supreme Court of Colorado would address this issue, essentially came to the conclusion that Sharp 1 got it wrong. It reached that conclusion in determining that although the Sharp 1 court purported to apply the restatement second of torts, the Sharp 1 court essentially missed a key provision. And the key provision of the restatement, of course, was Section 432. And as the court is aware, Section 432 says that causation can be established in one of two ways, either but-for causation finding that the defendant's negligence was sufficient in and of itself to cause the harm complained of. We're, of course, cognizant of the fact that we're asking this court to agree with a federal court's prediction of what the Supreme Court of Colorado would do, and we recognize that that is not necessarily a usual thing to do. However, I think if this court compares the Sharp 1 decision with the Tenth Circuit's decision in June, the court will see that that is a persuasive authority, and of course we recognize the Tenth Circuit doesn't control here by any means, or of course neither does Sharp 1 for that matter. I think it's telling in this case that as far as I'm aware, there has been no effort to defend the logic of Sharp 1. It has essentially been an exercise of, Sharp 1 said this, we don't care what the Tenth Circuit said. And I think that's telling. I don't think Sharp 1 can be defended, quite honestly, on its logic. I think that the Tenth Circuit was not being extreme or being novel in coming to the conclusion that there's this key provision, the restatement, that simply got missed. And therefore, we believe that if the trial court in this case had applied the restatement second of torts standard for causation, that in fact the company's motion for a directed verdict should have been granted. Now, with respect to outrageous conduct, the primary issue before this court is the trial court's performance of the gatekeeping function that it is required to perform under Colorado precedent, essentially the trial court's obligation to evaluate the conduct at issue and to determine whether reasonable people could disagree as to whether the conduct is outrageous or not. And of course, when we speak of outrageous conduct in this context, oddly enough, again, we look to the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 46, which is the governing standard in this state since the Rugg versus McCarty decision of 1970. And of course, the restatement says that outrageous conduct is conduct that is so bad, is so extreme, that it is intolerable in a civilized society. That being the case, of course, the primary theory of outrageousness in this matter before the court was that a social worker at the nursing facility was rude to Mrs. Regal approximately 30 minutes before the emergency medical technicians arrived to transfer Mr. Regal to the hospital. Mrs. Regal's testimony in this regard, I think, is the key portion of the record. And there, Mrs. Regal testified that Ms. Cho, the social worker at the facility, essentially said to Mrs. Regal in a quote-unquote caustic voice that essentially if there was an emergency, that the nursing facility's nursing staff would have called an ambulance. And I think it's important that when we look at that interaction, we understand what the record reflects was going on in other parts of the facility. And the record there reflects that at approximately the same time, the Nurse Pemkowitz, I'm sorry, there are a bunch of difficult names in this case, but Nurse Pemkowitz is one of those names. And Nurse Pemkowitz at this time, or approximately at the same time, was reviewing a fax copy of a preliminary x-ray report that had come into the facility because earlier in the afternoon at approximately 1 p.m. On the day in question, Mr. Regal had complained of shortness of breath, and therefore Nurse Pepkowitz had contacted Mr. Regal's physician, Dr. Carey, and had received an order to have a stat x-ray performed, among other things. So at approximately the same time that we have this interaction between Ms. Cho and Mrs. Regal, we have the record reflects that Nurse Pemkowitz has read this preliminary x-ray report, has paged Dr. Carey, and has talked to Dr. Carey, and Dr. Carey has essentially said, let's get Mr. Regal to the hospital, and she complied. I talk about that other part of the nucleus of facts, for lack of a better phrase, because I think the cases are clear in Colorado that the totality of the conduct must be considered. But what I also think is important, and it comes from this court's decision in Green versus Quest Services Corporation, there the court explained that in performing this gatekeeping function, that the trial court must consider the conduct, not the consequences. And of course, in Green was a case where several homes were destroyed because a utility company accidentally nicked a gas line, which caused an explosion. And there, this court, a division of this court, said that we don't discount the consequences of the harm in that case. Losing one's home is a very significant fact. However, the conduct at issue in that case, while grossly negligent, the court acknowledged, did not rise to the level of outrageous conduct.
Counsel, sure. You're familiar with the, again, another difficult name, DeCicco?
DeCicco, yes,
DeCicco, Your Honor. Case that's relied on by Ms. Regal, excuse me. How is this case really different from that case in any principled way?
I think that the principal distinction, Your Honor, is that, of course, in that case, you had a hospital administrator who knew that a woman in the community needed emergency medical assistance, needed an ambulance. And the hospital administrator in that case had control over the only ambulance service in the county at the time. And that hospital administrator refused to send an ambulance simply because he didn't like the physician, the woman's physician, essentially. That's what the facts suggest. The physician, the woman's physician, had recently resigned from the hospital staff. And there's also, I think, an element of pecuniary self-interest in that case, and that the facts of that case suggest that, or they say rather, that the hospital administrator was demanding that the physician send the woman to his hospital, and the woman's physician essentially said, I needed to send her to a different hospital. So at the end of the day, Your Honor, to answer your question, I think the distinction is that there being a conscious disregard of a person who the actor knows is in need of emergency medical assistance. And the actor in question also has for lack of a better phrase, monopolistic control over what would to be theorized, I guess, as a public utility, the ambulance service, and that person refusing to provide that service. There's no evidence of that in this case.
Well, we do have, evidence that would arguably suggest at least a deliberate indifference to the patient's condition.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think that, again, looking at such things as the interaction, what Nurse Pemkowitz was doing at approximately the same time, we're certainly not contending that there's perfect care in this case, far from it. And we're certainly not contending that we're happy with what happened between Ms. Cho and Ms. Riegel, Ms. Riegel, rather. Of course, the record reflects that Ms. Cho was disciplined for that. But I would respectfully submit that the record here does not show an indifference to what was going on. There's no evidence, for example, that the nursing staff was out in the parking lot having a smoke break and really didn't care what was going on with Mr. Riegel. I think the evidence is quite to the contrary. Certainly wasn't the care was not up to the standard that we want it to be and expect it to be. But I don't think that this case is anywhere close to DiCicco. That being said, if I could briefly talk about the issue of punitive damages, I alluded to the fact that Ms. Cho was disciplined. That, of course, is relevant to the question of whether there was ratification of the acts in question or approval. That, of course, being necessary for a vicarious liability assessment of punitive damages in the absence of actions by managerial agents. Now, we respectfully submit there's no evidence of ratification or approval in this case, nor do we believe that there is any evidence to support a finding that any of the Alpine employees whose acts served as a factual predicate for the punitive damages claim, that any of those employees served in a managerial capacity. That being said, there's a disagreement, I believe, in the briefs as to what the legal standard is for determining whether someone is a manager for purposes of the punitive damages issue. We respectfully submit that even if the court applies the standard that is proffered by appellee in this case, which is essentially, does the person supervise anyone else, that there's no record, no evidence in the record in this case to support a finding that any of the agents in question supervised other employees. There is evidence in the record that Mr. Merrill was an employee of actually a different LLC than any of the LLCs in this case, I can't recall any argument being made in the trial court that anything that Mr. Merrill did served as a predicate for punitive damages in this case.
I'm trying to think of supervised side of the system.
You're correct in mentioning his name. There was testimony in the record that Mr. Merrill, essentially that the administrator worked with Mr. Merrill on in this facility. With
history role?
No, to be clear, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that there has been no argument made that anything that Mr. Merrill did justified punitive damages. Thank you, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I'd like to preserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jay Reinen, and this is Jordana Gingrass, my associate, and we represent the Riegel family. Counsel. The standard review that the defendants ask you to apply in this is a much less deferential standard than what I think the law really requires. We had a jury trial in which I think there's no question that the jury was properly instructed on the law with a couple of issues that they brought up, but the jury was properly instructed to listen to the evidence. The jury was given form, fairly stock jury instructions on such things as causation, on such things as punitive damages, on such things as how to consider the evidence. And they really did a good job, I think, of listening to that evidence and coming up with a verdict, which I believe would require something more than what the defendants have argued to overturn. The standards of review on really all of these issues is whether or not any reasonable juror could have reached a different conclusion.
Counsel, on the causation issue, this is a question of law as to whether the court properly instructed the jury on the law. So that's a de novo review, isn't it?
It is. It is as to that issue, and that is one of the issues in which there is a lesser standard. However, if you look at the standard that Fishman v. Kotz talks about, and that is that the court should look at the jury instructions as a whole and determine whether or not the jury was properly instructed as a whole. And on the issue of causation, they were. There were two different jury instructions that the jury received in this case on causation. One was the Sharp 1 jury instruction that the defendants have been talking about, but the other one is the Stock jury instruction 9:20, which is a causation in fact jury instruction, and the jury received both of those. And so in order to reach the conclusion that they did, they would have had to read 9:20, which was jury instruction 26, and determine whether or not the acts and omissions of the defendants in this case were a cause of Mr. Riegel's death.
That instruction is the but-for instruction. And would you agree that the Colorado Supreme Court has consistently articulated the but-for standard as the test for causation in Colorado?
I agree that they do, and that's why that is a that's the Stock jury instruction on causation.
All right. Next question is, isn't it logically possible that an act can increase the risk of harm, and this gets to the second instruction, but yet not be a but-for cause of the harm?
I suppose that is a possibility. However, if the jury read those two instructions together as they were supposed to in order to reach their conclusion, they would have had to apply the but-for standard to reach a causation verdict.
On the other hand, the jury might have read the but-for causation instruction and viewed it in the light of the subsequent instruction on the substantial risk of harm and thought that the increasing the standard or the risk of harm satisfied the but-for test.
I see where you're going with that. I respectfully don't agree that that's how the jury would have formulated these instructions, looking at them together and reading them as a whole. My perception is that if they read them as a whole, especially when they are filling out the ultimate jury verdict form in the end where it brings up the causation again, that they would read the language that says that the negligence was a cause which would, without that cause, would not have caused Mr. Riegel's death. I think that they would have to read that to reach that but-for conclusion in order to find a verdict in favor of Mrs. Riegel on wrongful death.
You're saying that the verdict court said without
which? You know, I don't have the jury instruction. It's the standard 9:20 jury instruction. Right. I think that the way that the verdict form reads it is it asks them to look at what the definition of cause is, and the definition of cause would be listed in that 9:20. As far as Sharp 1 is concerned, that's never been overturned. It was an appropriate jury instruction to give. The Tenth Circuit has said that maybe it could be or should be or might be overturned, but what the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals says about Colorado law is not binding on this court or on the Colorado Supreme Court. And so far, this court has declined to overrule the other division of the Court of Appeals that reached Sharp 1.
Well, have occasion to even address it in the 25 years. I couldn't find an intervening case in that period in which we'd addressed whether Sharp 1 was correctly decided or not.
And I haven't seen that either, Your Honor, but I think that in light of the facts of this case, as well as the fact that both jury instructions were given, this would not be an appropriate case to use to overturn Sharp, since the jury was instructed on both the 9:20 and on the Sharp 1.
Well, you know, it does kind of raise the question in my mind as to, we do have the Stock instruction here, but yet you offered this additional instruction expressly on causation. It kind of raises the question, well, if we have the Stock instruction and everybody agrees that that's a good instruction, why do we need this other instruction? Unless you think that this other instruction somehow lowers the burden.
I don't think that it does that. And in this particular case, independent of all that, it would be a harmless error, even if it was an error to instruct in Sharp 1, because in this particular case, we have all kinds of evidence of medical causation of death. It wasn't just that Mr. Regal had a heart attack that caused him to die. It was that they ignored his orders to give him extra water and to monitor his water intake so that he wouldn't become dehydrated. Two doctors, including both of his treating doctors, testified that he had right-sided heart failure, which required him to have more fluid in his system than a normal person would require. And that's why there was an order to give him double doses of water and food, because he needed that. They were supposed to watch that. They didn't. He stopped drinking on the 25th. He took in absolutely nothing on the 26th. And both of the doctors said that this in someone like Mr. Regal would cause a heart attack, because it caused his system to overwork. His heart had to pump much harder than it would if he was filled with fluid. And so both of those doctors said, independent of the heart attack, that causing someone like Mr. Regal to become dehydrated was likely a triggering or a concurrent causative factor in his death. And Dr. Reeves was very, very strong about that, saying that if this man had come to us in not a dehydrated state, there's two different things, that his heart wouldn't have worked so hard. We would have done a cardiologic intervention, an angioplasty, and his kidneys wouldn't have shut down. And one of his causes of death was kidney failure, and the kidney failure was caused by him becoming dehydrated, which caused him to lose perfusion to his kidneys, which caused this whole chain of events. And I think that Dr. Reeves and Dr. Carey both put it very, very well for the jury. Look, this was a snowballing effect. It was a chain of events. When you cause someone to become dehydrated, and especially in Mr. Regal's condition, this is what happens. It causes his heart to work hard. And then, of course, we have the medication error. Not only did they screw up on not giving him enough water and monitoring his water intake, but they also gave him Coumadin when he wasn't supposed to, giving him a critically high Coumadin level. As far as the outrageous conduct is concerned, it's not just that that Ms. Cho was taunting or mean to Ms. Regal. This was, as in the Zalnitz v. Dotson case, just a circumstance of horror for Mrs. Regal. She went to pick up her husband in the morning. He looked horrible. He was sweating. He was clammy. He was not cognitively alert. She went down the hall and said, "What's wrong with my husband? Something's wrong with him." And they said, "He's fine. He's old, 66. This is what old people do," is essentially what happened. She persistently throughout the day, as he got worse, tried to get help. She asked that he be sent to the hospital. She asked several people to come in and help, not just Ms. Cho, but also Ms. Pemkwitz and other people at the nursing station. At one point in time, she went down the hall crying, asking, "Will someone help my husband?" And they all made her feel like she was crazy. That's what her testimony is. "They made me feel like I was crazy because I was asking for help in a healthcare institution for my husband who looked really sick." And it was capped off by going down to the case manager's office, Ms. Cho's office, and saying, sitting at her office and crying, asking for help for her husband, and then being blown off and made to think that she was being overreacting and being crazy. That's what the outrage was. And as Pearson v. Concilia says, and a lot of cases that have followed Pearson v. Concilia, when the degree of control by the defendant is higher, the bar for outrage is lower. In this particular case, we're talking about not someone who's at home making a phone call to 911, but rather someone who is in a healthcare institution that is being paid a good deal of money to take care of this man's health, a place that is a mile down the road from a hospital that could have picked him up and saved him. And she sits and thinks about this every day. If I had just cried a little more, if I had just screamed a little more, if I just talked to seven people instead of five people, maybe my husband would be alive. And that's where the outrage is. It's not just one interaction with one person. It is a series of bad interactions, outrageous interactions, with a series of people who are paid to take care of this poor man.
Is the outrage that they were rude, or is the outrage primarily that they simply didn't take care of him, notwithstanding?
That they didn't take care of him, that they evidenced a conscious disregard for his well-being, a reckless disregard for his well-being. These people didn't even assess him. They didn't call his doctors. These are not people who are qualified to make diagnoses. They were making diagnoses. The diagnoses came from a social worker, came from an LPN who's not even a registered nurse. And you know, it's multifactorial. Here we have a situation where this gentleman is supposed to be, he's being paid by Medicare to be on a Medicare unit, a unit that is staffed with registered nurses instead of LPNs, a unit that's supposed to be hospital-like, not nursing home-like. They defrauded this family, and they, in fact, defrauded the government by putting a Medicare resident who is being paid Medicare reimbursement in a long-term nursing home unit with less staffing and pretending that he's on a Medicare unit. While he was there, the last couple of days he was there, he only saw LPNs. That's who his primary caregiver was an LPN. It was supposed to be an RN. And the testimony came out that the RN that was scheduled to be the head of the unit was Darlene Brown, who was the director of nursing, and a director of nursing can't work on the unit as a unit nurse. Therefore, they were staffing this Medicare unit or this unit with an LPN instead of an RN. And so there's just so many things that play into this. And one of the issues that was brought up was, well, you can't have punitive damages because there was no manager involved. Well, under the Getz case, if the totality of the circumstances are that all of these people are acting in a reckless, with reckless disregard for the health and safety of Mr. Regal causing his death, then you don't have to have a management level person involved. But we do in this case. Ms. Cho was the director of social services and Mr. Regal's case manager. Ms. Pemkowitz, by virtue of the fact that they chose not to schedule an RN as the manager of this unit, was the manager of this unit de facto, even though she was an LPN. And there's actually a jury instruction, I think it's jury instruction 14, that talks about staffing requirements for these units, and they have to have an RN, and they didn't. So Ms. Cho was, by default, the manager of that unit, even though that was not her title. This is just, Your Honor, this is just such a really horrible way to treat someone like Mr. Regal, and the jury saw that, and they didn't see it unfairly. There was nothing unfair about what happened down below. It's just the facts. And you heard the defendant talk about, well, how they wish this hadn't happened and how they wish that the standards of care had been followed and how they wished that they had done the things that they were supposed to do with Mr. Regal. Well, they didn't. And not only did they not do the things they were supposed to do for Mr. Regal, but they treated Mrs. Regal awfully, outrageously. And they treated Mr. Regal with a conscious disregard for his health and safety. And this is from one of the largest chains of nursing homes in the country. This is a case where they should be punished and deterred for this conduct.
And
I'm a little confused.
Is outrageous conduct that they treated her poorly, or is the
outrageous conduct that they did not provide adequate medical care?
No, it's separate, and I'm sorry if I was confusing on that. Under the DiCicco case, there is a separate claim for wrongful death and a separate personal claim for outrageous conduct. In this case, the outrage was leveled against Mrs. Regal. She was. I guess I wouldn't use the word poorly. She was treated outrageously. I mean, here's a lady who is there to pick up her husband to bring him home, and he's sick, and all they are is mean to her, and all they do is refuse to have someone look at him, and they refuse her multiple requests to have him brought to the hospital. In fact, our expert testified that Mr. Regal would have been better off if he'd had this heart attack at home, because at least someone would have brought him to the hospital right away. Here he is at a healthcare institution, and they're abusing the wife for begging for medical care. Thank you.
correct?
Briefly, Your Honor. On the issue of causation, counsel asserted that there was all kinds of evidence of medical causation, and specifically pointed to the issue of dehydration. I can do no more than respectfully disagree with counsel's assertion as to what is in the record. As we pointed out in our answer reply brief, Dr. Reeves herself was essentially asked whether if Mr. Regal had been sent to the hospital a day or two earlier and essentially put on IVs, whether that would have increased his chances of survival. And she specifically declined to answer that question, saying that she was unqualified to do so. Now, Dr. Carey, I think the court will also see if it reviews the record of his testimony, specifically said that the 1.8 creatine reading, which was one of the points of evidence in the trial court below, was not concerning to him. Dr. Carey, who was Mr. Regal's physician, didn't consider that a major problem. And so, therefore, with respect to what I understand to essentially be an argument that there was evidence for a but-for causation finding in this case, there simply isn't the evidence there. With respect to outrageousness, counsel asserted that Mrs. Regal asked for her husband to be sent to the hospital. That is not in the record. There is no evidence of that in the record. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that Ms. Cho has no authority to send anyone to the hospital. She's not a clinician. And therefore, unlike the hospital administrator, for example, in the DiCicco case, she essentially doesn't have the authority to do that. With respect to the question of control, sure. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you for your attention.
Counsel, excellent arguments. This case now is accepted as submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.